You're talking about when the British went to India. The most amount of British that were ever in India at any one time, ever, was 20,000 in a population of 320 million. If they didn't want us there, they could have very easily kicked us out, but they did want us there. They wanted the trains and the roads and the medical advancements and the universities and the schools and the court. They wanted to see an end to Sooty. They wanted our help to keep the Russians and the Afghanistani armies out.
Welcome to the first ever episode of the Fox and the Furious. Because Calvin is sick this week and he's got man flu in America because he's having to live in the snow, I am joined by people may know her as Queen Bob on Twitter, and she's one of the best accounts on Twitter, always holding to account the mad people of this world. She was there when we started tearing down the Palestinian flags in London. She's one of the great friends that I've made in the movement against the madness. And every single morning I wake up and I see her, she's just going after people every day. So I'm going to call this episode, in the absence of Father Calvin, The Fox and the Furious. And it's going to be mainly bleep telling me how she feels about the world. How are you doing?
I'm all right, sweetheart. How are you?
Oh, it's
your
terrible.
Lovely son. Chucking it down here.
I'm having a horrible time. As you can see, it's really painful
horrible.
And difficult. Yeah.
It does. It looks horrible. It does. So, and I've got no sympathy for you and your sunburn.
Well, what do you mean sunburn? I look great. I want to start with UNRWA.
Yeah.
So Keir Starmer has recommitted his commission. He's recommitted his commitment, whatever that means, to UNRWA.
Yeah.
Tell me about UNRWA, will you?
I'm not actually massively overly read about UNRWA. From what I've seen the last year since October the 7th, they've been more on my radar than previously, because obviously they're supposed to be helping, but obviously we now know that a lot of them were involved in the October the 7th massacre. I just think there's all of these so many different groups now that are making money and claiming to be good. I mean, they're even giving 30,000 or 300,000 to the White Hats that have been accused of sex trafficking and organ harvesting in Syria. It's just like, it's just money, 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 isn't it?
So what do you make of the last, I don't know, 8 weeks of the political environment in the UK and worldwide? What have you noticed that has sort of caught your attention, that's made you go, oh, that's interesting, or that's a bit dodgy, or what are you noticing while you look at the world today?
I think it's just breathtaking. It's insanely shocking how incompetent and the inherent visceral hatred our government has for us. Since Labour have been in power has been horrific. But we were talking about it, like Labour are going to get in and they're going to be just as shit as the Tories, but just quicker. But I had no idea it would be this quick. And just so much has happened. It just beggars belief. There's no logic. So it has to be either stupidity or devilment. There's no other, for example, we got given a Labour MP in where I am in Cornwall. Cornwall has enormous population of elderly people, enormous population of poverty, really low wages. Cornwall, 75% agriculture. Yet this bloke who he was born in the area, but he's been living in Oxford for 20, 30 years, who's the CEO of an electric vehicle charging company, has carpet-bagged himself into our constituency, and he's voted against everything that we hold dear. He's voted to screw the farmers. He's voted against carers' allowance for poor people looking after relatives, and he's voted for the assisted dying bill. You know, we're a very, very Christian place. He doesn't care. He doesn't seem to care. He's just obsessed with filling his own pockets.
So tell us a bit about Cornwall. So you said to me once, which I thought was a really amazing thing, you said that Cornwall did its Black Lives Matter protest by refusing to buy rum and sugar from the Caribbean because they knew, the Cornish people knew what was going on, and they were very averse to what was happening. So for those people that are not British and who are watching from, I don't know, overseas, tell us about the relationship between Cornwall and Britain and the disparity in that relationship.
Cornwall has always been a bit of an outlier, a bit like Wales and Scotland, and we were sort of dragged into the United Kingdom kicking and screaming. And I think it was in the 1400s, about 15,000 Cornishmen marched on Parliament because they were sick of the taxes. We were just being taxed and taxed and taxed and taxed, and we weren't getting anything in return. So about 15,000 Cornishmen marched to Westminster. It was probably the first time that the people of Devon and the people of Cornwall put down the whole jam and cream debate and sided with each other. But unfortunately, there was an enormous, they were intercepted. I think it was Deptford Bridge, and they were mainly massacred. We had our own giant. He was huge, the giant of Bodmin. He was about 8 foot tall or something. And the ones that survived and the leaders, they were dragged into Westminster and murdered. Whenever there's a conversation, you know, about the United Kingdom, Cornwall's always left off as if we're not an independent country, but we're only not independent because we haven't really fought hard enough for it, and we didn't feel the need to. But we feel the same. Being Cornish is the same as being Welsh or being Scottish or being Irish. It's a national identity. We have our own culture. We had our own language. Some people still use it now. My aunt used to speak fluent Cornish. I never understood a single thing she said. We have, you know, our own customs, our own history. The Cornwall has given so much to the United Kingdom, and it's never really recognised. And now to see, and where my town, Camborne, was one of the richest places in the world at one point, because Cornishmen are really, really good at mining. So, for example,
Tin mining,
anything. But because it's in granite, because the land is so hard and the weather is so rough, they became very, you know, strong, incredible inventors of mining things. Like Richard Trevithick, who invented the steam traction engine, was from the Dolcove School of Mine in Camborne. But before he invented the steam engine, which obviously led on to the steam train and the entire industrial revolution, nobody even knows his name. That, you know, they all know Isambard Kingdom Brunel, but nobody knows Richard Trevithick. But before that, he invented a high-pressured steam pump that's basically an early version of a jet spray, you know, like you clean your path or your garage. And the boys from Camborne and Redruth got on a ship from Falmouth to Mexico, and they took it over there. The ship sank just as they reached the coast, and then there was a massive monsoon, and they managed to get the machinery onto shore. When they got there, the village they were supposed to mine, which was called Real de Monte, was actually miles away down a dirt track. Half of them died of malaria, their dogs died, their kids died, the priest died, but they still managed to get the machinery from Richard Trevithick there. And they reopened the mine, and then Mexico became financially independent for the first time since its invention. And these miners from Camborne, Cool and Red Roof put Mexico on the map. It was just a true fair until then. And I mean, even now in, we've got places in Cornwall like Mexico Beach and stuff like that. So, you know, Cornwall, so Cornish travellers, they always say where there's old, there's Cornishmen. They went to Canada, Australia, all of the massive mines all over Africa, you know, that brought wealth to the world from diamonds and gold and tin. All these advancements in technology came from Cornwall. We get absolutely no recognition for it at all.
Do you think that there's an element, do you think there's an element of the fact that there is a sort of, there is an independent streak in the Cornish people, which are like, we're not really English, we're Cornish. And that yeah. means that the English then, in their own sort of reactionary way, turn around and go, well, fine, then you be Cornish. But to just paint the picture again for the people that don't know the British Isles that well, Cornwall is the bit at the very, very bottom on the Naughty Elephant Skirt Water on the west-hand side of Britain. And it goes all the way down to this sort of funny guy Claw right at the end. And you've got Land's End down there. And you've got a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of culture down there. And there's a lot of...
Yeah.
These are very seafaring people, are they not? You know, and they would have been heavily involved in the slave trade. Would I be correct in saying that?
They were, yeah. I mean,
not them, not them particularly, but you know,
we did both. If I'm honest, like you'll notice, there's a lot of You will notice, like like Denzel Washington. There's a lot of black people called Denzel, or with the surname Rowe. And that's because a lot of wealthy Cornishmen, when they made their money through the minings, they went out to the colonies and bought up land, and they did have a lot of black slaves. So that's why you'll see a lot of black people with the name Denzel, like Denzel Washington.
Why Denzel?
It was only Fools and Horses. It's a real Cornish name. It's a proper Cornish name. Yeah. Like Jethro, the comedian, used to talk about Denzel Penberthy. So, yeah, it's a real Cornish name, Denzel. And actually, I was watching a really interesting Joe Rogan about, he had a guest on that's a linguistics expert, and he was talking about black culture in South America. And he was saying that sort of what we think of as that sort of black America southern drawl comes from Cornwall.
Yeah, makes sense though, doesn't it?
Gangster stuff, all that sort of they're actually all Cornish colloquialisms, you know, like IB, UB, that sort of thing, which was really funny to listen to hear two Americans talking about the Cornish. But yeah, we were invaded hundreds of times as well, and places like St. Cavern were almost entirely ethnically cleansed. But people don't understand the numbers, and this is one thing I try to put out. When you've got a village of an area of 200 people, and a Barbary slave ship turns up and takes 150 people, 150 people doesn't sound like very many, but that's almost the entire, that the genetics of that entire people almost entirely wiped out.
Are you saying that what happened was that there was a slave trade in white people?
Massive. The fishing industry was massively hit in Cornwall during the transatlantic slave trade, because every time our Cornish fishermen went out to sea, their ships would be captured. There's one famous one called Thomas Pellow, and he was a little boy from Flushing, where my family are from. And he was his family's boat was taken by Ottoman Barbary slavers, corsairs. And he ended up captured by these Muslim slave traders. But he somehow, it was a bit like Last Samurai, he rose up through the ranks, and he ended up with a Muslim wife and Muslim children. And then he became a general. And his sea knowledge was so incredible, because he'd been born on the boat, that they used his knowledge, and eventually he escaped and finally made it back to Flushing, where he's buried. But a lot of the Cornish fishermen went on strike because they were so sick of constantly being under attack, and it really affected the British economy, which is what gave people like Wilberforce power and the Cornish boycotts of rum and sugar and tobacco to go to Parliament and say, you know, this is the, we've got to get on top of this constant influx of Islamic raiders. I mean, they used to raid everywhere. Baltimore in West Ireland was affected as well, in Cork. And they used to, the Ottomans owned the island of Lundy just off Bristol and flew the Ottoman flag. And they used that as a processing centre before shipping people from mainly Cornwall and West Ireland off to North Africa.
So
they castrate them, separate them and send them off.
This is a story that no one really ever gets to hear, does it? Because I've been reading the Jonathan Sumption book. I think it's called Law in Time of Crisis or something like that. And he was talking about the fact that, I thought it was a really interesting thing, that Tony Blair began, actually Pope John Paul began it more vociferously, but this idea of apologising for things.
Oh, yeah.
So Tony Blair... Yeah, no, fuck it. I agree with you. But Tony Blair apologised to the Irish for the potato famine. And Jonathan Sumption raises quite a good point where he goes, well, who are you apologising on behalf of? Because if you can't work out who you're apologising on behalf of, then you can't really work out what you're apologising for. And
no,
therefore,
it's a disingenuous apology, isn't it?
Yeah. And so from your perspective, as you've watched the world unravel in the last few years, and you know, you've been very vocal about how you feel about stuff, what are the things that bother you the most at the moment?
Well, partly what you're talking about is there's just this constant othering of the British people and sort of demonising us all the time and making us beholden to things that have nothing to do with us and then punishing us for those things. I mean, when we talk about, for example, the transatlantic slave trade, people don't get the numbers. You know, when the entire population of the UK during that period of time was only 5 million people, the entire population was 5 million people. So less than 0.4% of the entire British population had anything to do with slavery. You know, my ancestors were either out at sea in the most horrendous conditions, or they were thousands of feet down a bloody mine for 16 hours a day, barely able to feed their children.
And why?
And somehow I'm supposed to be responsible for something that we took, you know, and all of these advancements when the British did go out to other countries. And that's another numbers thing that annoys me when you see people like Narinder Kaur. You know, you're talking about when the British went to India, the most amount of British that were ever in India at any one time ever was 20,000 in a population of 320 million. If they didn't want us there, they could have very easily kicked us out, but they did want us there. They wanted the trains and the roads and the medical advancements and the universities and the schools and the court. They wanted to see an end to Sooty. They wanted our help to keep the Russians and the Afghanistani armies out.
What's Sooty? Is Sooty when
Sooty
you
is when
burn,
the husband dies.
When, and they burn the wife.
Yeah.
Is that
they
right?
Wanted an end to the caste system. They wanted equality. They wanted trade. They wanted a single currency that they could trade more easily with and make money. They wanted weapons. You know, this idea that, you know, millions of British people turned up and took over India, it's not true. There were 20,000, 320 million people in a country 36 times bigger than the UK. The idea that we were a force that nobody wanted ever, and then, you know, and then when they thought 20,000 was too many, they kicked us out.
So would you say that history is not only being badly written, but it's been completely partisanly written against the population of this country, which is genuinely... So the assumption point, which I thought was really good, is that he basically says, you can't... Like, who's going to apologise to the dead? And then if you're going to apologise to the dead, then you're apologising to... You then have to apologise to the living to say that we are in some way... We've reached a moral plateau, which is you know, inescapable, and we're so good. But actually, without referring back to history, to what happened, to do that fairly, which is to turn around and say, well, you know, Cornish people suffered, and British people suffered, and lots of people suffered as the results of slavery, that we can't even look at this through a lens which is in any way accurate or in any way fair to both those that suffered and those that are going to suffer today. You know, the people of Camborne today, you tweet quite often about how much people are suffering in Camborne today.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, the people of Camborne also suffered. And yet we're supposed to buy into this narrative of the fact that, you know, in some way we're privileged and we're supremacist and we're a horrible bunch of people. What do we say to the, you know, I mean, Narinder Kaur's not a very good example because she's thick as pig shit, but...
She really is.
Yeah, she really is. But to the intelligent thinkers who want to turn around and say, you know, this is the legacy of the British Empire, I would say the legacy of the British Empire is really good because it is involved making big mistakes and then learning from them. And that would be the nature of civilization more broadly. Do you think that we're being too hard on ourselves? And if we are, why are we being too hard on ourselves?
Yeah, we're massively being too hard on ourselves. And, you know, having three children of school age, I hear the crap that they come home having been told by these, like, you know, middle class white teachers that, you know, have never left the educational system. And I think this is a big problem. I think this is a massive problem with the school industry, the education industry, and it has become an industry. And they are... I don't like the things that they're telling our children. It's absolutely disgusting. And we all have to remember as parents, we have power. It's like 30 of us to every one of them. And, you know, if you take both parents into account, there's 60 parents to every one teacher. And we have a duty to educate ourselves and read books and find out history and then counteract it. But, you know, I think when we were kids, we're about the same age, but when we were kids, teachers were also part of the community, and they're not now. They're like the police force or the civil servants, and they keep themselves to themselves. But teachers especially, I think, are a growing problem because they have never left the school system, bar from a few that, you know, have worked here and there or maybe worked in a bar or something whilst they were at university. 99% of them have been within the education system since they were 4 or 5 years old. And their mentality is like, you know, 9 till 3, 6 weeks holiday every summer, and always being the smartest person in the room. And that's really an massively unhealthy way to live your life. You know, a lot of the lessons I've learned through life is like when I, you know, if I've been sacked for being late or sacked for being saying something inappropriate or in trouble for saying something, you learn a lot from your peers around you. And I feel that more and more teachers just have no real conception of the real world. And they might work very, very hard. I don't doubt that they do work very, very hard, but I don't think they work harder than other people who work very, very hard. They certainly won't work harder than a farmer, you know, the people who we're taxing into extinction and oblivion. They don't work harder than a long-distance lorry driver that doesn't stop all week. They don't work harder than, you know, a local mum who works in the care industry and does a 12-hour night shift looking after dementia patients and clearing up shit all night and then still has to do the school run in the morning. They've just got this massive...
Why in the face of all of that truth are we still desirous to just hate ourselves? It's like, I want to know, is it like, I quite like the Morrissey quote that I read today or yesterday. It went, if you multiculturalism your society forever, you just end up with a society with no culture at all. And do you think that what's happening is certainly in America and what's happening here, it seems to be, you know, look, it's like the end of a marriage. It's like, I've got to hold on to something that's true. And what's true is where I came from and who I am and all that sort of stuff. Do you think that we're witnessing a switch in that? Do you think we're witnessing, we've seen the trial of Daniel Penny, he's got acquitted.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen America utterly reject Black Lives Matter. They're finished. It's game over. You know, do you think we're witnessing possibly people turning around saying, okay, well, we can talk about this stuff. We've got to be fair about it. Or do you think we're witnessing a backlash?
I don't know. It's hard to, I mean, once, now that the excitement of the Trump win has died down and the dust is settling a bit, I think there's a lot of frustration from Brits that feel like we're actually no better off and we're just looking, you know, over our neighbour's fence. But the thing is, it's, we like to think we're similar to the Americans and stuff, but we're not, because the difference is that the British people are native to these. This is our ancestral home. You know, when people go to America, when people have always gone to America, there's a certain mindset, and I think it's carried down through their, through your genes. It's like a survival of the fittest mindset. All the people from all over the world that travel to America to build America, the French and the Dutch and the British and Spanish and everything else, there was something innately in them that they no longer perhaps had a connection or an instinctive connection to their native homeland, and they were adventurous by nature. Maybe they're braver.
Hang on, I just got to interrupt you. Would that rule not apply to the indigenous people of America? The various tribes of American so-called Indians. Would that not apply to them?
Yeah, 100%. And that's my point. We see in the West that we have to look at the Maori people kicking off in New Zealand a couple of weeks ago in the court. You know, we massively respect that other people in other countries are indigenous and they have a deep rooted connection to their land. But we don't seem to see that about ourselves. And I certainly do. And what one of the worst multicultural things we're importing to the UK is Americanism. And this is what I think before we were so Americanized as a people, I think we did have that. Because I think the problems in America are different to the problems in the UK.
What is to Americanize? What do you mean by Americanize?
So, for example, they import... So I was looking through old archives the other day to write an article, and I've posted it previously, but it was a video, a film that was made in the early 1940s when the Americans got involved in the war. And it was a film that the American government created. And it was to tell American troops how to behave when they are in the UK during the war. And one of the things about it was there was these two soldiers that got off a train, and one was black and American GI. And as he got off the train, he shut the door, and the little old lady in the train, an old white lady, said, "Oh, it was so lovely to meet you. And the next time you're in Boston, from your Boston," that we're both from Boston, "and I was, oh, please come round. Here's my address. Please come and see us with your wife and children." And then the host of the American film turned round to the camera and he said, "You'll see that a lot here. They don't tolerate racism in Great Britain. They don't have the same race problems. And if you're going to come to America, come to the UK with your American attitude about race and think that you can get away with that sort of attitude, it won't be tolerated." This film was made by the American government in 1940. But we seem to have this mindset in 2024 because of the likes of Narinda and Dr. Shola and people like that, that Britain has always been racist, and it hasn't. It hasn't at all.
I went to the poshest school in the whole of England, and I encountered racism very rarely. It wasn't full of white kids. There were kids from, you know, there were admittedly some of them, most of the guys that were not white who were at Harrow came from very rich families overseas. And there was some racism, but I've never encountered this thing called systemic racism ever in my life. And I've hung out with loads of people.
Because in America, it's fairly recent to them. You know, their segregation and racism carried on until the 60s. So it's very recent to them. We haven't had that. In fact, during World War II, when the American troops were stationed in Launceston, the Cornish people hated the way that the American army was treating the black soldiers. So they literally kidnapped them and held them in their homes, gave them food and baths and a warm bed and washed all their clothes and wouldn't give them back. There's, if you go to Launceston now, there's still bullet holes in the walls because they call it the Battle of Launceston, because the Cornish refused to give back the black GIs until they had assurances that they were going to be treated nicely. In fact, Winston Churchill had to get involved in the end, and the American army sent tanks into Launceston. We've always been very, because of our Christian
warm, welcoming, intolerant, which I think is the...
So we think one of the worst things we've imported is American culture. Because
some of American culture. So I like the fact that without American culture, without the liberty and the freedom that comes with American culture, that we wouldn't have the idea that this man, Donald Trump, could come out of nowhere. I mean, not out of nowhere, obviously, he was a TV star.
They got that from us in the first place.
What do you mean?
The idea of freedom and liberty and free speech, that came from all of the Europeans that went there.
Right, yeah, okay, I buy that. That's fair, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, what we've imported, I suppose, in the last 20 years from America is this constant victimhood, this constant grievance culture. Not like that to actually live there, but that's what we've been imported via TV, radio, YouTube, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I my closest people in my life, other than my family, are not white indigenous British people, and they never go on about it. It's just not something they talk about.
So
as you look at the political landscape now in the UK, what do you think we are? I don't think Labour are popular. What do you think is going to happen as we head towards 2029? What do you think the bigger issues are in terms of, we don't want the, you know, Reform and the Conservatives cancel each other out because that's what will happen unless they do a deal. What do you like to see happen?
I mean, currently thoroughly enjoying the Lowe effect, talked about. Rupert Lowe, he's bringing out the competitive nature on both sides of the room, isn't he? Because he's doing it in such a way that's absolutely glorious, because he literally just asks questions. He just says, you know, I want to know, you know,
how many roots need translators?
You can't answer it because you won't like the answer. And Rupert's like, I just want the answer. It's a perfectly reasonable question.
Why have no other politicians done that though?
That's what's disgusting me. Is, you know, you got Robert Jenrick has jumped into action because he doesn't want to be out there. He can see, I think all the Tories are terrified, not of Farage. I think they're terrified of Rupert Lowe. The Tories are absolutely petrified of buying. And
because it's common sense. The thing about Rupert Lowe, which I really like, is that he is very first principles guy. If it makes common sense, then he'll ask the question, and he's got a huge amount of support. So it is interesting to ask oneself the question, okay, if you need government support, as anyone in this country, how many people need interpreters for that government support?
Yeah, and therefore, how much does that cost?
If you need an interpreter, how invested are you in becoming British? Whereas that's when I would switch on you, but you know, for want of a better term, say the American system is better, is that that you're incentivized to become American, whereas in Britain you're incentivized to remain the same.
Absolutely.
Because we're so guilty about the way that we behaved. And the earlier part of the conversation was, you said, you know, we don't recognize the fact that British people have also been through this, and time immemorial people have been through this, but perhaps we need to acknowledge that everybody has suffered at some point or another, and the Americans are actually just a bit further ahead because it's an idea rather than a nation, you know. And maybe that, there's something in that. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. But yeah, I think if Rupert Lowe carries on what he's doing, but I keep trying to remind them that, see, I wrote an article about reform, mainly about
it's Farage and Tyson. It's a very good article, I thought.
Yeah, and I'm told by people within that circle that everybody's been given apparently strict orders never to have anything to do with me.
They do not associate with
this. We should be flattered because it means I didn't know I was that important, to be honest.
Well, but that is great that we are. Democratization of speech is such an important thing. And what reform's answer seems to be is to go, we will not associate with people that criticize the things that are not doing right. And then, but how does one hold together the idea that something like a very, you know, principal conservative value of something like the right to life and fighting for the right to life, the reform very split on that. So therefore, are they a genuine alternative? Someone said to me the other day, they said, you know, it all looks fine and dandy now, but the minute they have to drill down into policy, because what Rupert Lowe is saying, we all agree with, but they're going to have to do a policy document at some point, and it's not going to have Rupert Lowe written at the top of it. So my suggestion and my offer, actually, and it is an offer, is to spend some money putting some lawyers, including the greatest lawyers in the land and the greatest thinkers in the land, to put together a real political party constitution for whichever political party wants to provide an alternative to Conservatives, if the Conservatives can't get their act together, to say this is how we make sure that it's not just run by Nigel Farage, a great man it is. It could have the opportunity to be run by Rupert Lowe. There is a way of turning around and saying we could create a political constitution for a party for the people, which is a grassroots led by the people, where they can vote in and out these guys. Because at the moment, the Nigel Farage show seems to me to have less luster than it used to.
Yeah, that's what worries me. And that's that was my point of my article. My article, I was accused of trying to bring down reform, like I'm that important position, I think, but it wasn't. I want them to do really well, but they have to remember that most people aren't on Twitter, and most people in rural places like where I live chat away in the street. And I was trying to give them information that basically things that hold people back, things that held people back in July. You know, in July, Labour won by a Rizzler paper. They didn't win by much. It was just that the Tory and revote, the reform and conservative vote was split. But collectively, there wouldn't have been a Labour if they had worked together, or if one had stepped back, or, you know, and things that were frustrating people were things like Vice saying them lot when on the Unity March. The things holding him back were people are still really angry about the vaccine mandates. We've got a huge amount of care staff in Cornwall and care homes in Cornwall. And when Richard pushed the vaccine mandates with Dr. David Ball and agreed that they should all be sacked for not having a vaccine, bearing in mind they'd done the first 9 months risking their lives for the elderly with no vaccine, no PPE. And then to see them sacked on Remembrance Day of all days, to sack people for making a free choice about their medical choices, that's really stuck with people. And I have tried to repeatedly say to him, you need to apologize. You need to recognize that that was a terrible choice. You need to, and the people are really forgiving. And that was mainly the point of my article. Richard, if you just say to the public, I was wrong about vaccine mandates, I was going by the information that we had at the time. I now recognize that wasn't the best thing to have said. I now recognize that should the same thing ever happen again, I would never push for anybody to have their medical condition.
They won't do it. And this is the thing.
He won't do it. And he lost this whole area by being stubborn about it.
I saw Farage being interviewed by Kay Burley, I think, earlier today or yesterday, and Sue made this point about James McMurdoch and his you know, history where he's done something bad in his life and he's obviously picked himself up and he's put himself back on the right track. But Farage talks about what he calls Christian forgiveness. He says, but what about Christian forgiveness? And I would say, okay, well then to avoid being a right-wing wokist, you have to apply the same level of Christian forgiveness to new conservative leader who admittedly, I think has been very wrong on immigration. And I think she should own that. But also to turn around and say, I'm trying to deal with the root and branch causes of what is breaking our country apart. And what's breaking our country apart is cultural. It's not about all of the stuff that politicians talk about in Prime Minister's question time. It's just not, that's not what it is. So I would like to see a fair trade-off between reform and the Conservatives to say who's got the idea to take us forward rather than who's going to attack the other one, because that's what Labour are doing anyway. So what is your message to the political class and to those people that are desperately looking for change as we go towards, you know, a changing world? What do you say to us?
I think they need to remember who they are and who the largest voting demographic is in this country, which is still currently the white working class. And 51% of them are women. And I think that is being forgotten. And the women are the ones that go shopping. Invariably, they have to feed their families. So the women are the ones that are having to... are listening to what their kids are coming home with. Don't, you know, from whether it's elderly women, business women, small business, you know, mums at home, you know, everybody forgets them. But they always say behind every good man is a good woman. And we all need each other, but always and forever, it's the women that are forgotten and the working class boys are forgotten. I mean, their school attendance, opportunities for university, they're more likely to be killed, more likely to be mugged. You know, just not forget the working class and stop blocking people because they say things you don't like. Maybe engage with people, Richard Tice, you know, who actually want you to win and actually want you to do well and actually want to see a change from the two-party system. And maybe grow up a little bit, because you're going to hear things you don't want to hear sometimes. Grow a bit of a thicker skin and support your candidates, because there's a lot of candidates in local areas that just have no support.
I think we've got to see how it all unfolds. And I think that we need to, I think one needs a sort of primary objective. And the primary objective for me is to destroy wokeism. What I want to do is we'll do this again when I'm home and I'm not in sketchy internet area. But we will discuss the Fox and the Furious, because you've got so much to say and you're so wise and you know you're a perfect example of someone who's really bothered to look into stuff, and I really admire you for that. And before the internet goes off again, I don't want to give Theon too much editing. It is to say thank you for joining us for the first ever episode of The Fox and the Furious with me, Lawrence Fox, and her. Beep. Love you.
And you. Love to Betty.
Bye, darling.